This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot-button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. This is Bennett Kelly, and welcome to another edition of Cyber Law and Business Report. And it's good to be back. We are once again teaming up with the illustrative Miami Book Fair, and we have with them one of their authors, a man by the name of Patrick McGilligan, who has a book with HarperCollins called Funny Man, Mel Brooks. And so Patrick is the author of Alfred Hitchcock, A Life in the Darkness and Light, Fritz Lang, Nature of the Beast, George Cukor, A Double Life, and books on the lives of directors Nicholas Ray, Robert Altman, Oscar Micheaux, and James Cagney, Jack Nicholson, and did I also mention Clint Eastwood? He's also edited an acclaimed 5-volume backseat series of interviews with Hollywood screenwriters and Paul Buell, the definitive Tender Comrades, a backstory of the Hollywood blacklist. And he lives in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where he's calling in from today. Thank you for joining us, Patrick.
Thank you for inviting me.
I wanted to start off by saying so about this book about Mel Gibson, but I gave it away with the lead. So we are talking about Mel Brooks, and it's astonishing that you have one man. You know, he has the EGOT, which is the Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony awards, which a number of people have had. But he also has 3 of the American Film Institute's 100 Funniest American Movies of All Time: Blazing Saddles, number 6; The Producers, number 11; and Young Frankenstein, number 13. So, I mean, it's quite. He's quite an esteemed comedic director. But even with that, I have to start by asking a kind of a question. I'm familiar with Brooks, and obviously, his movies were part of my growing up. But what is Mel Brooks today? Do people know Mel Brooks?
Well, it may be generational in the sense that older people know Mel Brooks really well. And younger people, when I show something like Blazing Saddles to my film class, I teach at Marquette University here and have for about 20 years, a lot of people are seeing it for the fourth time, having watched it with their parents. And a lot of people are seeing it for the first time. And, if you ask them afterwards and give them a little quiz, who is what German singer is being spoofed in the film? What do what does one flavor of Howard Johnson's ice cream make a joke about? Right. They're not getting, they're getting very, very few of those references. And yet, they really like the spirit of the movie, and they're laughing throughout the entire movie. So there's a lot of Mel Brooks that probably is generational, even his comedy. And he took his comedy largely, as I bring out in the book, you know, from his own boyhood and from the 30s and 40s and people that he adored, and then later went back and in various ways pirated and reshaped and turned into his own. You know, that kind of vaudeville comedy and shtick comedy, that itself may have gone by the boards. You know, I say in the book that, you know, his greatest sin at a certain point was having farts be funny and Blazing Saddles, and then later on you get Dumb and Dumber come along and Bridesmaids, and, you know, people are doing amazing things in the toilet, which are quite funny. So he got kind of one-upped by the new generation, and he was pretty clean comedian, really. I mean, there's not graphic sex or love scenes in his movies at all. They're really, you know, straight out of 30s and 40s comedies in some way. And there certainly isn't very much what you would call frank or vulgar language. So
right.
He's a, you know, for younger people, I think he's a sophisticated taste, to be honest. But for older people, he's a brand name.
Right. Yeah. No, we all, yeah, I grew up with it, and I've seen most of his movies and as a kid, and yeah, Mel Brooks is someone that you looked up to and you associate with a certain type of comedy. I do have, although it's funny you mentioned the, you know, the fart jokes, is that, you know, he actually once complained to Carl Reiner about watching something about, oh, I can't believe they're doing that. And Carl Reiner kind of shot back at him and says, Mel, you're the one who started this.
Yeah. Well, like I say, he's a relatively, you know, I would call clean comedian. We know who are the comedians who stand up and, well, you know, starting yeah. with people like Lenny Bruce and George Carlin, you know, who made a point of being very frank. He's not that way. And I think he, you know, he really opened the gate in a lot of ways. Of course, the culture opened the gate, and then he was there also.
True.
And probably... You know, probably he's proud of that because he's a funny man. So he probably thinks those films are funny. But he, you know, I talk about in the book how when Airplane comes along, and, you know, God knows the Zucker brothers are fairly clean also. But they're probably more risque, let's put it that way.
Right.
And, you know, he's kind of grumbling, you know, at the new generation at times. They, of course, all adore him. And recognize him
lead.
As a, you know, yeah. as a father figure of their kind of comedy. So eventually, as time goes on and he becomes almost sainted, you know, in the American culture, he embraces almost all comedy. And so that is sort of like a grumpy remark that he makes to Carl Reiner when they're watching Saturday Night Live one night. But he's capable of being grumpy.
Yes, and we all. But I do have, when you came to with the idea of doing this book, I guess was what was driving it was kind of, you know, he was a director that you just were drawn to as because you liked his comedy.
No, the honest answer is always the contract. You know, that there's a negotiation and a mediation and a long discussion about who you should do next, or who might you write about now. And he wasn't first on my list, and I'm not even sure he was in the top five, but he was on the list, and the list kind of got whittled down. And I'd never written about, you know, a contemporary comedian, because he's certainly contemporary with you and me. And I knew he had a great career. I had been on the set of History of the World. When I lived in Hollywood, you saw him all the time, you know, dining out and waving to people. And so I knew he would be a really great subject. And also he was a great subject that hadn't been written about in depth, very extensively, very well in terms of his entire career before. So that was very attractive. And I do, you know, there are a couple of his films I adore. And so I wasn't approaching it as a great, you know, he's a great filmmaker. So it's a little bit different than writing about Orson Welles or Alfred Hitchcock. And the difference was fun for me. I mean, in other words, that was part of the challenge and part of the intrigue. The publisher was very, you know, they took their time to come around to the idea of Mel Brooks. He was always on the list as a very, very dynamic, interesting character. And they were partly put off or worried that because he had made noises over the years about writing his own autobiography, and they hoped to publish it. And I always said, you know, when they brought that up as an objection, well, let him write his own autobiography, all the better for me. You know, then I can, you know, that's one-stop shopping for his point of view about
right. Yeah, that's it. That's mining gold.
Yeah. And of course, he really never did. He's done, you know, 10,001 interviews where he's told anecdotes, and often the same anecdotes. So that's the kind of book I think it would have been. But I didn't, that didn't bother me. I do something different. I mean, if a person's autobiography is sacred, they should be allowed to say anything they want. They should be allowed to disremember, lie, build themselves up, however they want to tell their life story. I believe that's a constitutional right of someone to write their own autobiography any way they care to. Badly written, go ahead. But a biographer has a different obligation.
Right. I was just going to mention, you were talking about autobiographies and, you know, their right to write it as they choose. And I was just going to add, and also claim that they were misquoted, and as Charles Barkley once did. But
yeah, I mean, and that's, of course, you know, one of the things, is that one of the hardest things for a biographer really is to read those 10,001 interviews and decide if someone has been misquoted or where they correlate or where they are the same, and to determine what you believe to be truthful and factual. So because people can be misquoted, we're on tape, so I can't be misquoted, but right. People can say things that they didn't mean to say, as you well know. So right. I take that very seriously. So I try to represent someone truthfully, and I don't believe, and I mean this very sympathetically, that everyone is truthful in their autobiographies. They're just not.
True. So, one reason I was asking the question was, you know, you wrote a biography of Clint Eastwood that ended in, you know, had some litigation as a result. And given Mel Brooks's litigiousness, was that at all a factor in the decision of what, you know, do I do this or not?
Well, to be honest, ever since I was sued by Clint Eastwood, everything I do is looked at very closely. And litigiousness on the part of someone in Hollywood who is alive is almost a given, although it's not always the case, but it's often the case. So we try to be as truthful, as factual, as fair, as balanced as possible, considering the content sometimes of what's in his life story, and to take into account that, yes, in the book, for example, there are some very interesting and significant court cases that he was involved in. I would not define him as litigious, you know, for the fun of it, or even litigious about his image or persona per se. He's definitely litigious about his credit and his money and where money is concerned.
Right.
And the book makes that very clear, and so we did anything that was litigious, but lawyers are very careful with me. I was doing my Alfred Hitchcock book when I was being sued by Clint Eastwood, and the lawyers spent hours and hours on the phone with me. The first thing they always want to know is somebody dead? You know, because if someone's dead, then they can relax. So, you know, I'm constantly proving that someone is dead by, you know, supplying an obituary. But when someone's alive, when you're writing about a live person, of course, all the stakes go up for concern that you were, you might be sued. You know, when I turned in my Clint Eastwood book in a draft form, you know, the editor said, you know, do you think we might be sued? I said, have you read the book? You know, first of all, he sues everybody at the drop of a hat. You know, he is litigious. And, you know, secondly, there was a lot of material in the book that he might sue over. So nobody published that book in a carefree manner. Everyone was very, very careful about facts and truth and realized we might be sued anyway.
Right. Well, you're feeling lucky, kid. So with this, has Mel Brooks responded at all to the book?
No. I mean, people don't necessarily respond to books. You'd be surprised. You know, I wrote a book about Jack Nicholson, who doesn't sue, isn't litigious, doesn't read what's written about him. But I used to work at the Boston Globe. So somebody who was at the Boston Globe brought it up to him in an interview and asked, you know, has he read this book by McGilligan? And Nicholson said something like, no, I wouldn't read it because it makes me feel like I'm dead. And you know what? I find him to be the high mark of sophistication in Hollywood, where publicity and worrying about what somebody writes about you is concerned. I wrote a book about Robert Altman, and he told Rolling Stone in print that I must have been drunk when I wrote it.
That could be a compliment in some cases, but yeah.
Yeah, knowing Bob, who is one of America's greatest filmmakers of our time, without question, and who I adore, and who's a very difficult person, it was a great compliment. But he didn't sue.
That's all that matters, yeah. It's funny you mentioned Jack Nicholson. I remember my wife knew a woman who was you familiar with the seat fillers at award shows?
Yeah.
So when this, for those who aren't listening, at the various award shows, if someone goes to the bathroom during a commercial break and doesn't return in time for the show, when the show resumes, they have someone who's dressed up and sits in that seat, wherever that may be.
Well, yeah, it's funny. I've been to the Oscars. It took me a moment to click on to what you were saying, but yeah.
Yeah. I actually did it once before a minor show, but the seat filler got the seat next to Jack Nicholson at the Oscars, and unfortunately, or actually maybe not, it was the in memoriam section, and they said and this person relayed how, you know, Nicholson was in tears during part of it since these were his friends and contemporaries. And then also at the very same time, a true Irishman, and was just trying to tell her stories about all these people. And it was just an amazing experience for her. But any event.
Yeah, I mean, when I was doing that book, for example, people would call me up, friends of his would call me up and say, hey, I have Jack's tickets to the Lakers today. I'd be out in L.A. doing my work. And would you like to come and sit in the seat next to me? Because he's going to say, who's that guy? And I'm going to say, it's your biographer, Jack, you know, just to nettle him, you know. Whereas the opposite occurred in Mel's case, because, you know, one of the things about Mel, and I mean, this should be no surprise if you love his movies and love his persona, is that, you know, when he's mad or upset, or even when he's just like in a mood, and Jack can be this way too, he will scream in your face. And so there were people who didn't speak to me or took a long time thinking about talking to me, not because they were afraid of being sued for saying something untruthful or not factual or even uncomplimentary about Mel. They were afraid Mel was going to scream at them, you know, when he found out or when he found out what they said. Same thing in the book, because, you know, he would even scream in script conferences, you know, the writer of Robin Hood, you know, is said to have feared that he was going to drop dead of a heart attack. He was screaming so, you know, loudly at one point. So, he controls people in a different way than just by being litigious. He controls by being the boss and being the loudest voice in the room.
She was, yes. Now, it would, in approaching this from, you know, from my perspective, since so much of, you know, before this book, so much of what I knew about Brooks was just what I had observed and had seen of my own, I was not that familiar with his TV work. And so, which is kind of a good place to start kind of diving in. And, you know, he got his break, you know, first, you know, doing the Catskill circuit, but you know, he got his break in TV, working for Sid Caesar as a writer in the 50s, right?
Yeah, he bonded with Sid Caesar in the Catskills and then later on reconnected with him. And at that point, Sid Caesar was a nobody playing his musical instrument in a band. But then after World War II, Sid Caesar took off like a rocket, and he was appearing in New York, and Mel went there, and they bonded. You know, in the beginning, Mel was really kind of his tag-along and run for coffee and laugh at all my jokes, kind of Gabby Hayes, you know, like a comedic Gabby Hayes guy. But Sid Caesar was undoubtedly the first person to notice that Mel Brooks was really, really funny, and that he could write. And the writing for Sid Caesar, just as he begins in his television career, first with a show called The Admiral Review, Sid would be upset not having a good closer to the joke or a real capper or like something really funny to say at this moment. And he'd leave the meetings really angrily, and Mel would be waiting outside in the corridor, and Sid's a big, tall, strong guy, you know, taking big strides, kvetching about this sketch, it doesn't work. And, you know, Mel's, they're pitching him ideas, you know, and that's how Mel got into the writer's room of Your Show of Shows, which is a famous, famous writer's room. Initially just two writers who are personages in the book. And then, you know, he works his way up to becoming kind of indispensable to Sid as Sid's, you know, alter ego and a guy that Sid really likes and gets along with and doesn't mind traveling with and thinks is really, really funny all the time, except when he doesn't, and then they argue.
When he hangs him out the window of a hotel.
Yeah, early on in their relationship, it was much more lopsided. And, you know, there's some people that think that Mel played the jester, you know, a little bit too long, and that it enabled some of Sid's bad behavior and when he was working, because he was famous for his tantrums and his rages and his egos. And yes, at one point, very, very early in the relationship, he, you know, Mel was in Chicago with him complaining that, you know, he wanted to go out. It's after the show. Let's go out. Let's go see what's on the streets. Let's go to the nightclubs. And Sid Caesar was a guy who, like, after work, after doing his show, he just wanted to, like, drink and sink into quiet. And, you know, he kind of became invisible after work. And, he finally got tired of Mel complaining and grabbed him and opened the window and hung him out from whether it's the ninth floor or the 14th floor or the fourth floor of a Chicago hotel, dangling him by his feet. Are you out far enough yet? You know, Mel says, okay. You know, and so it's a famous anecdote. Sid's brother, who always traveled with him, was in the room saying, Sid, let him back in. But you know what? It made for a funny anecdote, and that was part of their bond, is that Sid could do things and Mel thought they were really funny.
Well, imagine doing that in the workplace today. But you understate some part of the show of shows and the writer's room. I mean, the other writers are legion. Carl Reiner, Neil Simon,
And his brother Danny and
Danny Mel Tolkien and
Larry Gelbart, Lucille Callan, who was part of the original two with Mel Tolkien. They really created Your Show of Shows. The producer did too, and so did Sid Caesar, but they created the format. Yeah, and then later on Woody Allen, and you know, I I say in the book that someone, when they reunited all the writers, those writers at the Writers Guild for a panel and an audience, you know, in the 90s, said this is, you know, made the wisecrack that this is the greatest writers ever assembled in one room since Shakespeare wrote alone, you know. And they were pretty famous, a famous group. I make the crack in the book that they rarely were all in the room at the same time. And Woody Allen did not appear at that panel and audience. He only worked much later for Sid on specials in the late 1950s, largely with Larry Gelbart. So they worked at different shifts. You know, they actually felt, and I tell this story in the book, they felt underappreciated at the time. And other television shows were winning Emmys for best writing. And there's a point at which the Sid Caesar show, which is the follow-up to your show of shows, is nominated for an Emmy for best writing. And all the writers go to the annual banquet in New York. And they're just desperate finally to win an Emmy because they've never won. It's always Sergeant Bilko or some other series that's winning. And they announce the award, and it does go to like Sergeant Bilko or another series, all of whom had sterling groups of writers, you know, some of whom had gone through the Sid Caesar mill. And, you know, Mel supposedly jumps on the table and screams, "There is no God," which is a good story, even if it's apocryphal, because they were, you know, at the time they were not as famous as they became later on. And at the time they were celebrated, but not as celebrated as some other TV series.
Or knew it today. And the other thing that I wasn't aware of is how that writer's group was portrayed in other medium. So I was not aware that Mel Brooks's character was the inspiration for Maury Amsterdam and the Dick Van Dyke Show, for example.
Yes. There are three great examples. I mean, they've kind of been borrowed from and depicted in various ways in other works, but there's the Dick Van Dyke Show, which was done by Carl Reiner, who was the second banana on your show shows after the first like year and a half, and rose to stature on that show first as a performer, but then he started joining the writers. And Carl Reiner is an amazing writer, with as amazing a writing career as Mel Brooks or anyone else we're discussing. He created the Dick Van Dyke Show, and Rose Marie is supposedly a sort of a parody of Selma Diamond, who was a later writer for Caesar, and Maury Amsterdam is kind of the Mel Brooks. But I mean, the great thing about that show is that he's not Mel Brooks and she's not Selma Diamond. All those people are so individual. Show so well done. Then later on, Mel comes along and he does My Favorite Year with Peter O'Toole as a flamboyant kind of fading Errol Flynn kind of figure who appears on a Your Show of Shows kind of show. And it's a fantastic film and critics really, really loved it. It was Richard Benjamin's first film as a director, produced by Mel and his company. And written by one of the Blazing Saddles screenwriters who never gets enough credit, Norman Steinberg, and by Mel, who didn't take credit, which is not really the story of his career, normally speaking, who worked very, very closely on the script to make it as close as possible to, let us say, the emotional truth of that story. And then later on, Neil Simon comes along and does Laughter on the 23rd Floor, which I think is really... underrated, terrific, terrific, funny, and very accurate depiction of the writer's room. And it's more about the writers. That play is more about the writers. Whereas the other two, Dick Van Dyke Show is about Dick Van Dyke, and My Favorite Year is about a lot of things, including the Peter O'Toole character, who has really nothing to do with your show of shows or the Sid Caesar show, except that they had famous stars come and do, you know, a show or two.
Right. Now, speaking of credit, we have to give credit to our sponsors. So we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have more on Funny Man, Mel Brooks, with Patrick McGilligan. After these messages, you're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Are you looking for the best in WordPress speed, security, and scalability? WP Engine is a digital experience platform for WordPress, powering digital experiences for large brands around the world. With easy-to-use site management tools and powerful do-it-your-way development features, WP Engine gives you the flexibility to build it your way. Improve your SEO and conversion rates with a faster site on WP Engine. Learn more on WPEngine.com.
You are now tuned in to the world's largest online radio podcast network for internet marketers looking to dominate the B2B marketplace.
Webmasterradio.fm.
Webmasterradio.fm is home to some of the most respected authorities in all aspects of internet marketing, from SEO to affiliate marketing to social media, e-commerce, mobile marketing, and so much more. Our hosts travel to all stretches of the world and speak to the impact players that are affecting our industry. On air, on demand, and available on every mobile device that you can imagine. This is WebmasterRadio.fm.
WebmasterRadio.fm.
We're everywhere.
Do you look at the task of ranking your site at the top of the search engines like you would climbing the top of Mount Everest? It doesn't have to be. TopSEOs.com knows how hard that climb can be, and they can make top ranking a reality. TopSEOs sends you to only the right search vendors and agencies that they know will work for you. Since 2002, TopSEOs.com has reviewed and researched the best search engine marketing agencies and solutions providers. Don't risk the cost of falling off the proverbial peak of search rankings. Let TopSEOs give you peace of mind. TopSEOs.com, the independent authority on search vendors.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back, and we're talking with Patrick McGilligan. He is the author of Funny Man, Mel Brooks, and we talked about his background at the start of the show, but the important thing we didn't mention was that he will be appearing at the Miami Book Fair on November 23rd as part of a panel, Hollywood Lives, Real and Imagined. And I also didn't mention that he actually had been made an appearance in Game of Thrones. Is that true?
Yes, it is. You've done very good research. Well, I was teaching at Queen's University in Belfast on a Fulbright. I was teaching nonfiction life writing and screenwriting to students, and my time ran out. I was done with all my chores, and I was teaching a student who wanted to write a script that she would star in and direct herself. So as a kind of pleasant joke or a nicely intended joke, I said, "So what are you doing for your day job?" And she said, "Well, she does a lot of extra work." And I said, "For what kinds of shows?" And, you know, she mentioned Game of Thrones, and I'm the only person in my family who hasn't read or seen a single minute of Game of Thrones. And so I knew it would really, really anger everybody if I somehow got on this show. So I went through all the rigmarole of, getting my measurements, my neck measurements, and my health approved. And yeah, I spent a day on Game of Thrones, got paid really well. You eat really, really well. And it's a very interesting, I knew it would be interesting to spend a day with the extras, and the extras were great. And I made lasting friendships, and some of them had, did this really for a livelihood, and they had been on a lot of Game of Thrones shoots. And they told me the whole story of Game of Thrones, pointing out the stars who I had no idea who they were, explaining where the scene was going to fit. We had to sign secrecy agreements, so I couldn't write about it, which I did for the Los Angeles Times until really, I think, the week after the episode was over with. And I'm only can be seen very briefly. But it was a wonderful gig, and everything about it was great, except it was really, really hard work, and it was very arduous, because, you know, your call was 4 in the morning, you worked till 6, and if you worked past 6, you got overtime, so they were really, really eager to get you done at 6. I was there on the day where they had set a record for number of extras, like something like 600.
Wow. I forget. When you say 6, are you saying a.m. or p.m.?
You start at 4 a.m. and then you work till 6 p.m. and you're on your feet most of that time.
Wow.
In you know, bad sandals, costume sandals, you know, out in the sun, doing, I'm sorry to say, take after take, slower, faster, spread out, bunch together, scream, don't scream, this of the same scene over and over again. So there's a tedium factor too. And young people, because when I initially applied, I thought to myself, well, how many guys in their 60s could possibly be trying to get on Game of Thrones? Well, the answer is quite a few, and a lot of them are tremendous specimens. The young people, the specimens were doing okay. A lot of the young people were like dropping to the flagstones. You know, I mean, it was hard work, and I'll back repeatedly because I think if you make it through and you do okay, they call you back because they're using hundreds of people. I got called back repeatedly and never went back.
Interesting. So
it was fun.
You will be, you're definitely part of a historic show, so that's a great thing to have. Getting back to your book, so Mel Brooks breaks out, and I did not know that he was the creator him Buck Henry of the Get Smart with Don Adams.
Yes.
And so this starts his trajectory on his own. And quite a successful 1960s period where you have Get Smart. And then he writes and produces a movie that would become his defining event because of the way it keeps popping up again. And that is The Producers.
Yeah. It provides a great third act for the book, too, because it comes back, as you say, in his life. And it actually started about 10 years before, because Mel is a kind of a writer who needs a partner, and he's a writer who doesn't like to write, so other people write it down. Or there's, let us say, in Hollywood terms, he'd be the walker and someone else would be the sitter. And so he had been struggling to write this idea called The Producers, dating from the late 1950s. And first it was going to be a novel. Then it was going to be a stage play. And he was always in love with Broadway, and he wanted to do, you know, some kind of stage musical. So that was a very natural evolution. But by the time of after Get Smart, he encounters a collaborator, a friend, who's willing to put in a lot of hard work with him, working on the script, uncredited. And I tell her story in the book. She helped him shape it into a script that becomes his signature script. And it really, you know, it's this, most people know the story. It's these two, you know, conniving, sleazy guys. One's a producer and one's his accountant, who have developed this idea to make tons of money by having a Broadway flop. So they want to have the worst possible idea for a Broadway flop imaginable. So they have a musical about Hitler.
Springtime for Hitler.
Yeah, and this is an idea that's very, and his concerns and his ideas, and he loves doing Hitler, anti-Hitler humor. So it was a success, the esteem. I think it did pretty well at the box office, but not enough to make very much money. But it won him an Oscar for best script, which is a great calling card, and really launched his career. And critics were very, as they always have been about Mel, as they were, let us say, when he was active, they were very divided. You know, they found some of it to be tasteless and silly and not well directed, and other parts to be amazing and, you know, memorable and hilarious. So critics paid attention. And they have always paid attention to him because he's very interesting to write about, and his comedy and his sense of humor is very interesting to write about. And particularly in The Producers, and then later on with Blazing Saddles, and probably it ends with History of the World You know, he pushes various boundaries that today nobody would even recognize as boundaries, you know, but in those days still were boundaries.
Right.
Boundaries of taste.
Well, he did Springtime for Hitler alone, the song.
Considered incredibly audacious at the time. I think when you see the musical remake, which was such a tremendous success on Broadway and around the world and in road companies, and you can see the film of it too, because there's at the very end of his producing career, there's a film version of the musical. It doesn't have the same edge because so much time has gone by that that humor now is much more taken for granted.
Sure. Now, one thing, I'm wondering what your opinion is, and there is a growing trend in Broadway to steal from Hollywood. You know, it used to be the reverse. You would have a successful Broadway play, and then it would be made into a theatrical film.
Yeah.
And now we have this new, you know, this kind of new phenomenon. I'm not sure if the producers was the first or not, that led to them mining Hollywood for, the streets of Broadway. And you know, what is your feeling on that? Is that something that's kind of just the nature of the business, or does it reflect a kind of a lack of creativity or something about the marketplace of Broadway that it makes it difficult for new and artistic or worthy productions to come up?
Well, it's all of those things, and it plays into the culture as a whole. We know that it's true in Hollywood too. That now everything is the sequel of a comic book.
Right.
That people were reading in 1957, it's all of those things. I mean, it's certainly not only not Mel Brooks's fault, and I don't even think he contributed it to it, really. It's the opposite in his case, that he was always in love with Broadway, that he had intended originally at one point that the producers be a musical. There's a lot of great music in the original film, some of which is not in the play, but a lot of which is in the play because Mel writes music. And so for him, it's a kind of natural conclusion. There was a point, I talk about it in the book, in the late 90s, where he had really maxed out in Hollywood. He had maxed out with the studios, with audiences, and he had become surprisingly passé and not somebody that all the studios were trying to get to do to do another movie. So out of that period of really, you'd say near depression, except Mel is never depressed. He's so resilient. But out of that period, out of that low period, he goes back to this original, really love child, the producers, and he starts to recraft it. And it's not recrafted that very much, meaning it is very similar to the original film. There is a lot of the same music, but a lot of songs are added. They expand it. They do things for the stage. So for him, it's a natural and really a kind of triumphant conclusion to his career at a point in time when he wasn't looking, very strong. And his career as a filmmaker, as a film director, had basically ended and never resumed. And I think it's that third act that makes him, and I narrate this in the book, it's the third act that makes him a national treasure, because it forced everybody to take another look at him. Mm-hmm. And he begins to get, medals from Obama and Life Achievement Awards, and all comedians start inviting them on their podcasts and their TV shows. And he becomes celebrated in a way that he wasn't, exactly. He was always famous. He was always beloved. His films were always particularly beloved by their fans. But he becomes celebrated and, as I said, kind of sainted in a different way because of the musical of the producers. But for him, it's a natural thing. I think he tried it again with Young Frankenstein and did pretty well, turning that into a stage musical. And without Gene Wilder, who had conceived of the original script, who was in the producers, by the way, it was his big breakthrough. And then he was in Young Frankenstein as Young Frankenstein. But he also wrote and conceived the script that Mel collaborated with. And then he's been talking about still doing it with Blazing Saddles, which again is a film with there's no music in Young Frankenstein. Or there's no songs.
Well, it was one song and dance thing, I think. Wasn't
oh,
it?
Yes. One famous song by
Putting on the Ritz, wasn't it? Yeah,
by Irving Berlin, right? So, one song that they had to really, wangle, for the stage version. But unlike Blazing Saddles, which has several, really famous songs in it, mostly written by Mel, he's been talking about turning that into a stage musical. I don't know how they could do it, but, I think one of the things that you're saying about Broadway is you can do it, and it doesn't matter, people will come. Right. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's not Oklahoma or My Fair Lady, people will come because you already have, I'm talking about him being a brand. You already have that brand and that name recognition, and people who grew up seeing that movie and say, "Oh, I'd love to see the musical version."
Right, and so it's, which is funny because his movies have music. And so then to do a musical of the movie. And so let's just jump into Blazing Saddles, which got him his second Oscar, strangely enough, best song.
Yeah. Did he win? I have to read my book.
He did, yes.
Yeah.
I might be able to put you in touch with the author. Yes, he won. He wrote the lyrics and he didn't write the music for it. But yes, he actually won an Oscar for best song.
For the theme song.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and, which is really hilarious. And they had the great idea of mocking it up so it sounded like a, typical cowboy Western song.
But it's interesting. You have, it's the people who are almost in it and the people who are replaced in it. So at one point, I was aware that Richard Pryor was going to be in that movie. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, Richard Pryor was a great helper on the script. I probably wanted to call him a helper. There were like five screenwriters, and he was key because they convened all the writers at one point, and Mel looked around the room and said, "I just see Jews. We need a black person." And then Richard Pryor really kicked up that element. And I think, look, for me, Blazing Saddles is the best Mel Brooks film. But why do I say that? Well, I think the script is absolutely great and really brave and all of its racial commentary, most of it inspired by or written by Richard Pryor being involved in the early script conferences. He did not like script writing, but everyone said he had a very powerful effect on the screenplay. And one of the great things about Blazing Saddles is it's a very chaotic, messy movie with all kinds of silly, crazy things happening. And so for me, it has a lot of chaotic energy of the sort that Richard Pryor and Mel and the other people in the room who shouldn't be forgotten were really just, pitching in their best stuff. And a lot of it's in the movie. So it's, again, one of those movies where you wouldn't get all the textual references. You could study it, because there's right. a lot of things in the background. Mel's scenes, I think it's the movie for me where Mel comes alive as an actor. His scenes as the governor are very, very silly and very, very funny. You have Harvey Korman, bursting out of television, for the first time, and really Madeline Kahn, who was really just at that point in time was like a comet, attracting Oscar nominations. And she's splendid. And then the accidental casting, finally, because it isn't Richard Pryor, in the end. And then Gene Wilder coming in also at the last minute.
With a condition.
Kind of gives it a like less to me. Some of the later films are very canned and packaged and laden with shtick. And even though there's always an attempt to have a sort of carefree, chaotic mood, to what's happening on the screen, it's not very it's not very credible, like it is in Blazing Saddles, where it's happening naturally, you know, and all kind of crazy things, you know, right down to, you know, the full orchestra playing in the desert at the end while the guys are riding off in their Cadillacs to their dressing rooms. It's a very, very clever script. And I treat Mel throughout the book as a writer, writing about him as a writer, his struggle to be a writer, his struggle to write, you know, really to write his best, which means really to express himself. And strangely, and you know, you'll have to read the book to figure out, you know, the complicated reason why. Strangely, the film that has the most collaborators and the most disparate collaborators turns out to be a film that expresses Mel the best for me.
It's interesting. Well, then we're going to take a short break and we'll come back one for round. You're listening to the Cyber Law and Business Report only on webmasterradio.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
It passes before it's noticed. A slight rising of the eyebrows, a widening of the eyes. It may be accompanied by an almost imperceptible inhalation. The heart adds a beat like a quiet exclamation point on the experience. Within a tenth of a second, the reaction has passed, but not without leaving its mark. Someone found what they're looking for. Does your website deliver impulses to act? It can. Intended Consequences is the podcast for digital marketers who see their job as changing hearts and minds. If you're frustrated, bored, or in a rut, it's time to spread your wings with me, Brian Massey, and my guests. Find out how successful, curious, creative, and data-driven marketers are making a difference on purpose. Visit intendedpodcast.com or find us where you get your podcasts. Intended Consequences, marketing on purpose.
Ready to do a podcast for your business? Make that podcast elevate to enterprise level. Let WebmasterRadio.fm expedite and execute your podcast to build your brand and broaden your customer base. WebmasterRadio.fm has worked with the world's biggest tech brands, Google, Yahoo, and Bing, and have worked with fast-growing brands like ShipStation and GoDaddy. Now it's your turn. Contact BRASCO at WMR.fm and rush your enterprise-level podcast into production at a very reasonable rate. Email BRASCO at WMR.fm.
Do you look at the task of ranking your site at the top of the search engines like you would climbing the top of Mount Everest? It doesn't have to be. TopSEOs.com knows how hard that climb can be, and they can make top ranking a reality. Top SEOs send you to only the right search vendors and agencies that they know will work for you. Since 2002, TopSEOs.com has reviewed and researched the best search engine marketing agencies and solutions providers. Don't risk the cost of falling off the proverbial peak of search rankings. Let Top SEOs give you peace of mind. TopSEOs.com, the independent authority on search vendors.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back, and we're talking with Patrick McGilligan about Funny Man, Mel Brooks. And he was just talking about why he thought Blazing Saddles was kind of the embodiment of Mel Brooks and his best film. What is your favorite scene from Blazing Saddles?
Boy, that's a tough question. I actually watch Blazing Saddles every couple of years. I figure out some reason to show it to my class. Sometimes I'll show it in like a history of American film. And, you know, and sometimes I'll show it in another class for a different purpose. And I walk out of most of the films that I show because I've seen most of them in my life 10 or 15 times. And, you know, I think you get brain damage from watching a Hitchcock film that he really only intended for you to watch maybe twice,
right?
You know, watching it 10 or 15 times. But I sit in my seat and I watch, and I forget that I've seen it before, and I laugh. And I love the ending because I think that's what raises the film to a sort of modern modernistic comedy, modern comedy in a different way than others of Mel's works, where you discover that the whole thing has been a movie all along, and they break into the movie sets in a big fist fight, and then they end up eating popcorn in the movie theater while they're watching the movie. And then the bad guy comes down the aisle, you know, after them while they're eating popcorn watching the movie. It's very Godardian or Brechtian, and hilarious. It never stops to be portentous or pretentious. And so I like scene after scene, but by the time you get to the ending with Dom DeLuise as like the poofy film director and all the guys doing their chorus routine, I'm giggling, I'm chuckling. And I also watch it, you know, we started talking about this at the beginning. I'm also watching it to see what the kids are laughing at and whether the kids are getting it. And as I say, they don't really get it all, but they laugh.
Right.
Because the spirit of it is really, really, I think it's a big spirit. And it's a very inclusive film comedically, so that you can find, and it's still, you know, I wouldn't say you couldn't do that film, a film like that nowadays, because it's kind of brilliant and maybe you could, but it's still pretty bold in parts.
Oh, definitely. I mean, just some of the, especially the more risque scenes, you know, is that you're at or you're happy to see me, but
yeah.
And it's, yeah, I wonder what what the reaction was to the suits about the fart scene.
To the suits about the fart scene?
Say the fart again? Scene. You know,
supposedly when the studio first saw it at an executive screening, and I believe it because the fart scene is still funny. I'm not going to tell you it's my favorite scene, but it's still funny. One movie, and they saw those scenes. They came out of an executive screening at only a small number of people were at. And, you know, one executive gives Mel a list. I want that scene out where she punches the horse. I want the scene out with the farts. I want, you know, I want the scene. I want the dialogue with the N-word changed, you know, list, list, list. And then Mel goes into the bathroom, supposedly with the other executive. And the other executive is looking at him as he's like, you know, doing his business. And Mel balls up the list of complaints and throws it into the wastebasket. And the other executive says, good job. Good filing. And then they showed it supposedly again to the secretaries and common people on the studio grounds in a open screening, and everybody, you know, fell on the floor.
And that's good.
I believe that.
Well, to second what the producers or the executives said to Mel Brooks, to you, good job. Your book is being well received, and again, as we mentioned, you'll be at the Miami Book Fair on Saturday, November 23rd, talking Hollywood Lives, Real and Imagined, and so be sure to Miami Book Fair. I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us about Mel Brooks and your book and the other works you've done. It's been a great pleasure, and with and continue to become the wisdom from Milwaukee of with the insights on Hollywood. So best of luck to you, and thanks again for joining us.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And that's all we have for today. This is Bennett Kelly saying have a great week, and thank you for joining us again for another edition of Cyber Law and Business Report. Follow us on the radio, and best of and sweet dreams and the Hollywood memories to all of you. Bye-bye.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.
These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.